good to be back again this evening and encourage you to follow along with the lesson. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this subject, and I know, as I've mentioned during the lesson, that this is not the most prominent view among our brethren regarding the book of Revelation. And for that reason, it's possible that as I go through this, it might make someone a little bit uncomfortable about that. But I think last night's lesson so far of the series that I've gone over, to my mind, it's one of the more clear lessons about why this view is particularly important. We'll touch on that a little bit more in this lesson. But it's not my hope that I'm going to preach this lesson and just like that everybody's going to flip views. I don't expect that to happen. What I would be pleased with is if you look at this and you have never studied the book of Revelation, it encourages you to study. And if you've never considered this view, that at least I've given you enough evidence to give some second thought or some consideration to that. I mentioned before, and I'll again mention that a little bit more this evening, I think the views that many brethren hold, both the spiritual view and the view that this is addressing the persecution of the Roman Empire, I believe both of those are valid applications. I don't consider the brethren that hold those views to be heretical in any way. I believe those are valid applications. And the men that hold those views, I have a great deal of regard for. I have a great deal of respect for them on those views. But brethren, sincere and earnest brethren disagree on matters in the Scriptures. And it's good that we can address these things and have disagreements. The other thing to say about that is the view, the spiritual view, the view that it's talking about about the Roman Empire and the view that it's talking about Jerusalem, the main message is identical in all of those. And particularly whether it's Revelation or whether it's Jerusalem, the message is even closer and more prominent. And that's important that even though we disagree over some of the details, that we know that the main message, the victory of Christians over persecution and over persecutors, if we recognize that, then that is certainly a major stepping stone to move forward. This evening's lesson is going to be on dating of the book of Revelation. And when we look at the date of the book, somebody might have the question, well, why is the date important? Dave, does this have a laser pointer on it? It does. Okay. Is that okay? I've got it. Thank you. Why is the date important? Well, the date is important because some books, regarding some of the books in the New Testament, or any book in the New Testament for that matter, when you're studying it, the date is always helpful. It's helpful and it helps us, it aids us when we understand the book, if we know its historical context. And so very often when you look at a book that is talking, a New Testament book, you look at a study, they go over that. Who's the author? When was it written? Why was it written? To whom was it written? All of those are important. When you look at the letters of the Apostle Paul, when you can coordinate the writing of the epistles with the accounts in the book of Acts, again, that's very helpful to know what Paul was doing, where he was. It gives you some insight into the writing. So the same is true with the book of Revelation. But here's another important reason, and that is Revelation if you would open your Bibles, Revelation chapter 1 in verse 3, the Apostle John wrote, "Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy." If you go to chapter 22 and verse 7, John writes, "Behold, I am coming soon. Blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book." In verse 10, he says, "Do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book." In verse 18, he says, "I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book." And then goes on about anybody adding. And then finally, again in verse 19, He says, if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will add him to the plagues described in the book. So it's very clear from this book that this John is referring to this, and this is a prophecy. Well, if the book of Revelation was written after 70 AD, then it couldn't be a book of prophecy if it's talking about Jerusalem. You follow that? If the book was written after the events that it's talking about in the book, well, that's a simple matter. It's not a prophecy of Jerusalem if Jerusalem has already fallen. And that's one of the important markers of the book. That's why it's so important. I should say there is one writer that I have reading about. There's a man named N.W. Alphen. He was an early member of the church. He wrote a commentary on Revelation called The Voice of the Seven Thunders, and I'll tell you a little humorous thing about that. But The Voice of the Seven Thunders is the name of his prophecy, and he begins to explain that. Well, he takes the view that Revelation is talking about the fall of Jerusalem, but he takes the late date. And I think, now, how do you do that? And his reasoning here is here, and to some extent it's sound. He takes a view that even though it happened after the event, prophecy isn't always about telling the future. In fact, prophecy has the telling of the future has never been the most important part of prophecy. The most important prophecy, the most important message of prophecy is reform from your wickedness and follow the Lord. And certainly that comes into play as we look at this particular book. But for the most part, and I think I would agree with most brethren, if you could date Revelation soundly and convincingly after the fall of Jerusalem, that's going to eliminate the view this is talking about Jerusalem. Typically, we date the book based upon its contents. We don't determine its contents based upon the dates. In other words, we look in the book, we look for reference markers. The prophet Luke, the writer of the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, makes detailed references to historical events. Who reigned at what time and what was going on in this? One verse, and I don't have it, I don't recall it from memory, but there is a single verse that Luke wrote that has more than 17 historical references in it. He's trying to date a timeline, and because we know Roman history and Jewish history and how they overlap, you can virtually pinpoint the time period that Luke was talking about. And that's helpful to do that. Luke was long time ago, now many years ago, gospel students, for lack of a better term, thought Luke was not a really good historian because he made references to offices that they didn't think existed. They made references to individuals ruling that they didn't think existed and a number of things. And as we study and we learn more history, we find Luke was right. Now, we regard that just as a matter of inspiration. We recognize that Luke didn't write of his own sources. He had been inspired by the Holy Spirit. And so when things are there, they're there for a reason. But critical historians would look at that and they'd say, oh, Luke wasn't a very good historian. Well, the more they study, the more they learn, the more we learn, the more we find out he was a very careful, detailed historian. Well, we look at this particular passage. We look at this particular thing, and what we want to do is we want to look at clues inside the book to try and help us determine that. We don't generally look at a book in the New Testament and then say, okay, this book was written and then, and so that's going to determine what the message means. And yet that's what some people do about Revelation. They have looked at the external evidences and they use that to pinpoint the date and then use the date to say what the message of the book is. For the most part, when we're studying the New Testament or the Old Testament, we prefer internal evidences to external evidences. Why is that? The answer is because the internal evidence we recognize as inspired. The external evidences may or may not be inspired. And so that's why we generally put more weight on the internal evidence. When it comes to Revelation, and I mentioned this in one of the earlier lessons, some brethren tend to treat Revelation a little bit different. They put more weight on the external evidences than they do on the internal evidences in order to date the book. Now, I thought I got a commentary earlier today and out and looked at it, and it was Homer Haley's commentary. I'm remembering the wrong commentary, but one of the books that I read basically said that if you look at the internal evidence of the book of Revelation, it favors the early date. If you look at the external evidence, it favors the late date. And then the author says, for the purpose of this commentary, I'm going to go with a late date. And that's a way some brethren do. Now, when I looked at Homer Haley's commentary, Homer Haley didn't do that. He said, in fact, while a lot of people you look at internal evidences and favor the early date, he said he doesn't believe that the internal evidence favors the early date, and he thinks the external evidence favors the late date. So he chose to go with the external date. He chose both. But often, I shouldn't say often, but in several cases, brethren will look at the internal evidence, they'll look at the external evidence, and they'll lean towards the external evidence. And like I said, that's different from the way it is. Well, let's look at the dates suggested for the book of Revelation. It would be nice if we could go here and John said, I wrote this in such and such a time, but he didn't do that. But when you're writing a book, even though it's not a book of history, when you're writing a book about events, and particular events that will soon take place, there's going to be clues, there's going to be hints during the book about it. And when we look at this, and we talked about, I guess it was Tuesday night, we talked about all the different views. Some people view these things as past, some of them view as present, some look at future. And then we talked about the millennium, and some think Christ came in the past, Christ is going to come here, some think Christ is going to be here. It shouldn't be surprising to us then that when we look at the dates, there's all sorts of dates suggested for them. So let's look at the first of these. The first one is what is referred to as the early date. And that is the date that I prefer. That is the date that I feel strongly about. But the early date is generally any time prior to 70 AD. Most of the individuals that favor the early date put it around late 60s, as far as that is. Late 60s, not later than 70, because that would, again, make it not a book of prophecy in that sense. But that's what's called the early date. Probably the most common date for this is what's called the late date, which is around 95 AD. Now again, if the book was written in 95 AD, it couldn't have been a prophecy about the fall of Jerusalem 25 years earlier. So that's why the date is important. But there are other dates. Some people give a middle date to it, and that is, it's a compromise to the two. But these would say that it was written shortly after the fall of Jerusalem, which again would eliminate the idea that this is pertaining to Jerusalem. There's a date that's referred to as the later date, and that is during the reign of Trajan, which was after Domitian. And then there's one that I call the latest date. There are some writers, early Christian writers, who said it was written at a later time. These events were going to take place during the reign of a future emperor named Titan. The problem with that is there never was an emperor named Titan. And so we can scratch out the latest date. Most writers would scratch out the later date. It's most, for the most part, brethren go back and forth between the early date and the late date, either 70 AD or before 70 AD and after 95. So again, this is a timeline, and when we look at this, you look at the different things. Now here's something I want you to notice. If you look at this, when was the Gospel of Mark written? They date it between 40 and 50 CE, or AD, we would say AD. When was the Gospel of Matthew written? Between 50 and 60. When was the Gospel of Luke written? About 60. Gospel of John, this person dated the Gospel of John between 60 and 70. The letters of Paul, 48 to 67. And then the general epistles between 48 and 90. Do you notice something about that? Except for two exceptions there, and that would be Gospel of Luke, and I guess it is just the Gospel of Luke. When you look at that, every one of those books has a range of dates. And that's because when you're going back 2,000 years in history, when you go back 2,000 years history, narrowing something down to an exact year is almost impossible. I'll give you an example of that. When people talk about when was Christ born, you have a range there. Why? Because we're not even sure if the dates were correct. We have a pretty good idea when events occurred, but the date system that we have is off a little bit. And so people will say, Christ, I've heard people range anywhere from 4 BC to 6 AD. What's funny about that, of course, is that Jesus, BC stands for before Christ, and so they're saying Jesus is born 4 years before Christ. That's just a typical idea of how the dates are mixed up. But when you look at these things, all of these things are ranges, 10 years as far as that goes. And yet when it gets to when it gets down to the dating of Revelation, for some reason, a book of this much controversy, there are brethren who are dogmatic about, I know it was written in this date. We can't be confident when the Gospels were written down to a specific, and yet they look at Revelation and say, I know it was this date. We can't know that. We can't be that specific as far as that got. We have some ideas about it, and so we'll talk about that. Now, I mentioned before, when we look at a book and we try and to date it or even understand the meaning of it, we look at two different things, two different types of evidence, internal evidence and external evidence. Internal evidence are references and evidence from within the text, things that the author said that suggests a time or a place. And then the other is external evidence, and that is things that we know that happened outside of the book, or we look at writings of other people outside of the book that point to a different thing. And so when you look at the internal evidence and the external evidence, sometimes they seem to be in conflict, and that's clearly the case with the book of Revelation. We look at that and we see that there's two different kinds of evidence to weigh. Well, let's look at the arguments for the late date. I should say too, this, just by virtue of the time we have, I can't do an exhaustive examination of these. I have a book. I took it home today, but there's a book. It's 500 pages arguing for the early date, and that's just an example of, you could spend months literally studying the evidence for either or side, and we don't have time to go into that. So I'm going to touch on some of the arguments that I believe are the most prominent. The first thing is argument for the late date. Turn to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13, we read about a beast that rises out of the sea, and we'll talk briefly about that tomorrow. Beginning in verse 1, John writes, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words. And it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And the authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Now, as we look at this particular passage, individuals who have studied that and look at that, and they see in this emperor worship. And they say that is strong evidence, strong internal evidence, that this book is talking about the persecution by Christians by the Roman Empire. The problem with that is that the early date doesn't argue that this is not Rome. The early date recognizes and acknowledges that this particular beast is Rome, but there's no specifics in here about the actions of emperor worship. What a number of brethren have said is that, well, the if this was written in AD 70, emperor worship had not developed enough by AD 70 to have been acknowledged here. But that's only partly correct. The fact is that in Jerusalem, emperor worship hadn't evolved as far as that goes, but in Asia Minor, emperor worship had gone back for decades before this. The very things that were later practiced on a much broader scale had already previously been studied, had been practiced in Asia Minor. But beyond that, as I mentioned, the early date doesn't deny that this beast in particular, the one rising out of the sea, is the Roman Empire. The next thing is, if you recall from reading this, and we'll go back and read it again, verse 3, it says, one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. Now, this is a view that individuals have made in a number of commentaries, and I have to tell you, it's something that really amazes me. The idea, individuals will argue is this is a reference to something they call the Nero Redivivus myth, or Redivivus myth. And what that is, when the Emperor Nero died, he was such a tyrant that people were afraid of him, and a rumor or a myth started saying that Nero was going to rise from the dead again. When Domitian, which if I recall right, I believe Domitian is Nero's brother, but when Domitian became emperor, a lot of people in Rome thought Domitian was Nero reincarnated. And in a number of commentaries that I've read by our brethren, they say this passage is talking about the Nero Redivivus myth. But I have a problem with that, and I would think you would have a problem with that. When you look at this passage, John doesn't say this is an individual that looks like he came from the dead. Look at it again and see what he says. One of its heads seemed to have had a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled. So he's saying that this individual seemed to have had a mortal wound, but was healed. Nero did die, and we know he didn't resurrect and become Domitian. So here's the problem. You wonder, if you take that view that that is a reference to the Nero Redivivus myth, you have to say one of two things. The one thing you'd have to say is that John accepted this myth because that's what's described here. I have a problem with that since John was an inspired author. The other thing is, as I mentioned in day one, this is not really the revelation of John, the Apostle John. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ. He is giving this revelation. Would anybody suggest that Jesus believed the Nero Redivivus myth? I don't think this has any reference to the Nero Redivivus myth. And honestly, I think that that does a disservice to that particular. I don't think it's a very strong argument at all. The another argument that's made regarding the argument that this is Rome is they say Nero's persecution was primarily centered in Rome. In other words, it wasn't empire-wide. It was primarily directed in Rome, and so this persecution couldn't have been about Nero's persecution. The early date doesn't take the view that this is Nero's persecution. That's not the argument that's being made. The early date takes the position that the persecutions in the book of Revelation are by the Jewish people, and at times exploiting the Roman authorities to persecute Christians. Now, that's not to say that I would dispute that Nero persecuted Christians or at what time or even range. It's that that's not the focus we're talking about. That's not the persecution that I believe the book of Revelation is about. I believe the book of Revelation is in response to the Jewish persecution of Christians in the first century, not the Neronian persecutions. Another argument that is made for the late date is the spiritual condition of Ephesus and Sardis. I'm sorry. Turn back to Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2, and I want to look at verse 1, starting in verse 1. To the angel of the church in Ephesus write, the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands. I know your works, your toil, and your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear with those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and found them to be false. I know you are enduring patiently and bearing up for my name's sake, and you have not grown weary, but I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love you had at first. Remember, therefore, from where you have fallen. Repent and do the works you did at first. If not, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place. I'm going to stop at that passage, and then I want to go ahead to chapter 3 and read about the church in Sardis. To the angel of the church in Sardis write, the words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works. You have the reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up and strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God. Now here's the argument that is made from Ephesus and from Sardis. The idea there was Ephesus was a fairly young church, as was Sardis. And the timeline from the establishment of the church in the mid-50s to mid-60s until 70s, that was too short of a time span for Ephesus to grow weary in their drifting from their first love, from abandoning their first love. That's the argument that is made. It was too short of a time if it was AD 70, but 96 would have been more realistic. So here's a congregation, and just to give a rough idea, we'll say was established in AD 60. And that's a later date, but take AD 60, and they're saying in 10 years, a congregation could not have left its first love. And I can tell you as a gospel preacher, and I think any gospel preacher can tell you, there are numerous examples, even our own day, of congregations, new congregations, failing very quickly. Maybe starting out, bolstering strong, and then within a generation, dying off. That we can find examples of. And the same thing true is about false teaching and things like that. How long does it take for false teaching to topple a congregation? Not very long. Not very long at all. As far as Sardis, it's saying that they had a reputation that they were strong. A lot of congregations begin with a strong reputation. But whether they have the reputation or not, reputation is not fact. And when Jesus was speaking to Sardis, he wasn't saying, you really were good for a long time, but now you're not. What he said is, you had a reputation. You had a reputation that you were alive, but the fact is you're dead. Reputations rarely coincide with fact. And so that argument to me fails as well. Because again, congregations turn, sadly, turn on a dime at times. And so that does not, to me, appear to be a strong argument. Let's look at some others. The non-existence of Smyrna during Paul's ministry. This is a classic case of what we say, lack of evidence proves nothing. The fact that Paul doesn't mention Smyrna or Luke doesn't mention Smyrna doesn't mean Smyrna didn't exist. It simply means that they weren't mentioned. And to say there was no Smyrna because there's no references is like saying there were no gorillas because they aren't mentioned in the Bible. It doesn't work that way. If the Bible doesn't mention it, the most we can say is the Bible doesn't mention it. But we can't draw evidence from lack of evidence. We can't draw conclusions from lack of evidence. Probably one of the strongest arguments for the late date is a statement made by Irenaeus. Irenaeus was an early preacher. He lived early in the second century. And he has a statement that basically says that John wrote the book of Revelation almost in our own time, later in the reign of Domitian. But one of the things that is interesting is after Irenaeus, a number of writers refer to Irenaeus and say the book was written in 96 because Irenaeus says so. And people will quote Irenaeus and all these other people and say that was it. But the fact is, most of these other writers are quoting Irenaeus. So there's only one testimony. Irenaeus's manuscripts are very, are not very reliable. Among things, one of the statements that Irenaeus made was that Jesus lived to be 50 to 55 years old. Now, the reason I'm saying that is because a great deal of weight is put on Irenaeus alone. But when you look at the weight of a number of the early Christian writers, what's interesting are the dates for them varies just as much then as they did now. I don't have time to pull up the information, but it will be included with the information I lead with you. But Brother Steve Rudd, who maintains the Bible.ca, has a commentary called The Bible Only Commentary of Revelation. He has a section on there where he quotes from about 15 or 20 quotes from early Christian writers. And what he wants to show there is that the view about the date of Revelation, when Revelation was written by the early fathers, is anything but consistent. They were all over the place. What it was about, who wrote, some disagreed over who wrote it, and things like that. And I'm not saying that, and some people do make the argument that Irenaeus was trying to say that he saw John, not John saw the Revelation. I'm not even going to go there, and I'm not going to try and make that argument. I'm simply going to say too much weight is given to one man, and all of the writings of the other early Christian writers is being dismissed. The late date is simply not a settled matter, as some would suggest. Now, these are some of the advocates of the late date, and bear in mind, I'm not putting these up to call these men out. I respect these men. Homer Haley, Farrell Jenkins, Robert Hart Greider, and numerous other brethren lean towards the late date. I'm just putting this up so that you have some idea of some of our brethren that lean towards that date. Some of the other commentaries are by R.B. Sweet. I'm trying to think of some of the other, Jim McQuiggan and a few others take those dates as far as that goes. But the point of being this is men who are highly regarded, very knowledgeable, very respectable, take this date. And so that there is certainly credibility to it. I wouldn't dismiss the late date. But let's look at the idea of the early date as well. First of all, and one of the writers I'll talk about a little bit later made this argument. John A.T. Robinson was a well-known Christian author, a well-known historian, and linguist. He took a view that all of the books, every one of the New Testament books, was written prior to A.D. 70. And his main reason for that is nowhere in the New Testament is there any reference to the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, I want you to think about this. Most of the writers of the New Testament were Jews. They were Jews by nationality. They were Jews by culture. They were no longer Jews by faith, although I guess we could say they were true Jews by faith. But if you were born and raised in the United States, and then you moved to another country and you heard about Washington falling, the city of Washington being razed to the ground and leveled, when you were writing, do you believe there would be no reference to it at all? And that's basically the argument that John A.T. Robinson makes, is that there's nowhere in the New Testament is there any reference to the fall of Jerusalem or the temple that the Jews held in such high esteem and such high regard. Revelation, let's look at these passages. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 12. Paul says, I'm in verse chapter 2 and verse 12. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 12, we read, the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. Now, some people have looked at this and they said, well, he mentions New Jerusalem here. And so that would suggest that old Jerusalem has fallen. But if you go to Revelation chapter 21 in verse 2, when you look at this passage, he shows the coming of the New Jerusalem coincides with the fall of the old Jerusalem. And that was future, not present and not past. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 2, and I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Notice the tense there is future. I saw these things happen, coming down. That's looking at future tense, a future part of this vision. So the New Jerusalem mentioned in chapter 3 is still looking towards something that was yet future, not present. So it couldn't be called the New Jerusalem. It was called the New Jerusalem because John's vision was going to reveal that, not because Jerusalem had already fallen. Furthermore, in Revelation chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, we read, Then I was given a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar of those who worship there. Now, when you look in the book of Ezekiel, it's clear that the temple did not exist. And so what's being measured is not the living temple. But in this case, There's no indication here that this is talking about a spiritual temple. The evidence here is he's talking about the temple in Jerusalem, and he's told to go out and measure it. So that suggests, at least, that the temple was in existence, and we know when the temple fell. That was 70 AD. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 9 and chapter 3 and verse 9, I referred to these yesterday when I was talking about the theme of it, shows that much of the conflict that Revelation is concerned about was a conflict between Jews and Christians, not Romans and Christians. And again, that's not to say that I don't think Roman persecution of Christians happened. I do. I know it did. I'm not trying to deny that. But in Revelation, the conflict primarily that's mentioned here in the letters wasn't by Rome, it was by Jews. Another argument here is, and this is interesting, Revelation chapter 17 and verse 10. Revelation chapter 17 and 10, John is identifying one of the beasts. This is the great red beast, which was a harlot was riding top of it. But in verse 10, he begins to identify this beast. And we begin reading here. He says, "There are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while." There's been a lot of speculation about that. If you go back and you look at the Roman emperors, if you count Julius Caesar, the sixth emperor was Nero. A lot of brethren have tried to say, well, you can't count Nero because he wasn't an official emperor. That's because Julius Caesar reigned pre-empire. He was a pre-empire Caesar. And so some historians will classify Julius Caesar as a pre-empire emperor or a pre-empire dictator, and then they start counting with Augustus Caesar, and then Nero isn't the sixth emperor. But here's a problem. The people in the first century did regard Julius Caesar as one of the emperors. I mean, you think about it for a second and ask yourself this. When the Roman emperors are named Caesars after Caesar, how can you not include Julius Caesar as one of the Caesars? That, to me, makes absolutely no sense. But if you start with Julius Caesar and you count, Julius is the first, and you go through the list, Nero is the sixth Caesar, and he died just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. That would match with the earlier date. Here's some other arguments as well. The number of the beast. Again, in Revelation chapter 13, we identify, John is identifying this, and this is a number that I guess we could say lives in infamy. The apostle, whoops, I'm in the wrong chapter. Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13, starting in verse 16, John says, "And it causes all, both small and great, both rich and..." That is not the right passage. Let me see. Revelation 13, 16, 17. Let me back up for a second because it's the same section there. Revelation 17, it must be. Revelation 17. I'm sorry? 16, 18. All right, I'm looking for the where he identifies the number 666, and I apologize that my reference is wrong there. 13, 18. Thank you. Appreciate that. 13, 18 is where this beast is being identified. All right, now let's look at this beginning in verse, I'm going to start in verse 15. Also, it causes all both, well, I guess I was in the right passage. I was not reading that correctly. Yeah, there it is. I was in the right passage. I just was reading it wrong. Starting verse 16, "Also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. That is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of the man, and his number is 666. You've heard of that number. I'm sure you've heard that. And it's been dramatized in a lot of movies, and people will say 666 is referring to the Antichrist and things along this. John was identifying an individual here. And the way he was doing that was using a numbering system that was more common in Hebrew and Greek and Latin than it is in English today. And that is, each, like in the Roman numerals, each letter also had a number assigned to it. And that was the case in Hebrew, that was the case in Greek. And you could take names and use those numerical numbers and add them up, and you'd come up with a figure. This was something that was well known in the first century. Well, if you do this in the Greek, it doesn't work. And John indicates here that this calls for wisdom. If you do it in Hebrew, it works up to the name Neron Kaiser or Nero Caesar. And some people have tried to say, well, you can make anything, you can take those numbers and make any name of that, and we can see that people have done that. But the point is, John was trying to identify somebody. And almost every commentary acknowledges that the number that John had in mind here was Nero Caesar. Now, they try, and some of the commentaries try and say, point to that Caesar revivitus myth and say it's really Domitian, it wasn't Nero. But almost every commentary I've seen acknowledges that the number 666 is specifically identifying Nero Caesar. Here's an interesting thing. If you take the numbers in the Greek, you come up with the number 616. And some of the, in other words, if you take Caesar's name in Greek and add it up, instead of getting 666, you get 616. And some of the early transcripts or early manuscripts of the Bible, instead of saying 666, they say 616. And that's just more evidence that the person being identified here was not Domitian, it was Caesar. Unless you're going to accept that revivitus myth, that was. And again, you still have a problem with that if you think John believed or Jesus believed a myth. That wouldn't make sense. A few more arguments here, just really briefly. We talked about the number of the beast. Ogden's argument, Arthur Ogden wrote a commentary. He took the early date. And he took the position that this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. I touched on this last night. And really, to me, from an internal evidence, this is the strongest argument. When you look at the punishment that is being meted out against the enemies of God in this chapter, it focuses on the punishment of the apostles and prophets. And when you look at the writing of Jesus and the writing of the apostles, Jerusalem is the only city that is charged responsible for the death of the prophets. Rome has never charged with that. Jesus even said it was impossible for a prophet to die outside of the city of Jerusalem. Now, he wasn't being literal there, but what he is basically saying is Jerusalem is responsible for the death of the prophets of God. If the theme of the book is the punishment of the apostles and prophets, then that has to point to the fact that the enemy being spoken about is Jerusalem in this particular sense. Now, finally, the last thing I'll touch on this is some of the advocates for the early date. You may not have heard of J. Adams, Adam Clark. Alfred Edersheim was a Jewish convert to Christianity, regarded as one of the foremost Jewish historians as it applies to Jerusalem. In studying Revelation, he favored the early date, and he also favored the view that Revelation is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. John A.T. Robinson, I mentioned before, was a scholar, and he dated the entire New Testament concluding that all of the books were written before 70 AD. Philip Schaff was a, I'll call it a Christian historian. He's regarded by people as the father of Christian history. He literally wrote the book, 10 volumes on church history. He took the position first. He took the position, the late date position, and then after studying history and going along that, he alternated to the early date position, and again to the idea that Revelation is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Some of our brethren that have favored the early date, Brother Foy E. Wallace Jr., Arthur Ogden, Steve Rudd, Mark Copeland. Steve Rudd, Arthur Ogden, and Foy E. Wallace each wrote a commentary on Revelation, and each one of these went from a what they declared a Bible only. In other words, they simply looked at the book of Revelation, not outside commentaries, not outside literatures, and they all came to the same conclusion as well. Mark Copeland has a class book out about it, about the book of Revelation, and also takes the early date. Now, I bring these up again not to try and put weight to an argument, but just like I did with the late date, there are brethren on both sides of this date argument who are respected, who are highly regarded, who are highly knowledgeable, and yet they take these dates. And the main point, really, of tonight's lecture, although I lean towards the early date myself, is to just simply say that the late date is not a settled issue. Some brethren seem to suggest that it's a settled issue. We don't even discuss that. We have to look at the late date. It has never been a settled issue. Almost from the second century on, there have been individuals taking the early date and the late date, and there's strong evidence on both sides. So when we look at this again, my argument or the purpose of this lecture isn't to convince you necessarily that the early date is the best, but at least encourage you to give it some thought, to give it some consideration as far as that. I clearly lean towards the early date, but I certainly don't disregard anybody who leans towards the later date as well. To me, the strongest argument for the early date position would be the theme of the entire Bible, coinciding with the writings, pretty much the argument that I made yesterday in yesterday's lesson as we look at that. So as we look at this, this doesn't get us any closer to a firm understanding of what Revelation means. I think yesterday did a good job of that. The next two lessons I'm going to be giving are going to be focusing more on the book. And I guess I need to give a bit of a disclaimer. Thursday and Friday, so tomorrow and Friday, when I do this, I don't have time, I couldn't have time, to go over in great detail of what the book means and then go and show a lot of cross-references to do it. What I've got to do, the time I have to do, is simply show what I believe from the scriptures, what is being talked about, and then I'll leave that in your hands to do further study. This is something that while it is good to study, good to have a gospel meeting about, it is a detailed enough study that really it requires both individual and probably class study as well, but I hope that it'll encourage you to think about these things. Just like before, this lesson isn't specifically designed as an evangelistic message, but it is my hope that if anyone's living in a way that they believe is not acceptable, that they know is not acceptable, that they need to repent of that. And we encourage you to do that. If you're not living as you should, we urge you to repent of your sins, confess them to the Lord, and then pray for forgiveness, and we'll be happy to pray with you and for you if you come to the front while together we stand and sing.